You know how people say age is just a number? Well, turns out they were kind of right. Your calendar age doesn't always reflect how old your body actually is. I recently learned this when I took the True Age test from True Diagnostic. I was a little nervous to find out my real age, but get this, my biological age came back 6 years younger than my actual age. I was considering hanging my results on the fridge like we did for our kiddos when they were little. But here's the thing. It wasn't just a vanity boost. The test showed how different systems in my body are aging, like my brain, heart, immune system, and metabolism. Apparently, my brain is doing great, but my metabolic health needs a little TLC. So now I've got personalized tips, backed by science, to improve that and slow aging overall. And honestly, the test was super easy. Just a painless finger prick, pop the sample in the mail, and a couple weeks later, I had this incredibly detailed report that made me rethink how I eat, sleep, and manage stress. If you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code MINDFUL to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com, code MINDFUL at checkout. Your future self will thank you. Ever feel like your energy, focus, and recovery could use some extra support? Quicksilver Scientific is a U.S.-based company that manufactures advanced liposomal supplements, making nutrients easier for your body to absorb and put to work quickly without any added fillers. When I was in the middle of what seemed to be a personal health crisis, Quicksilver Scientific was one of the brands I could always trust to get an effective, high-quality product. I remember using some of their liposomal nutrients and detoxification supplements. Every formula is designed with advanced liposomal delivery that wraps nutrients in tiny spheres your body recognizes, helping them absorb quickly so you get more from every dose. They have clean formulations, non-GMO, no unnecessary fillers, and they're allergen tested. Quicksilver Scientific makes advanced liposomal supplements so you can actually feel the difference. Energy, focus, calm, recovery. Get 10% off plus free shipping at tryqs.com/mindfulmovement. That's tryqs.com/mindfulmovement. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
It's not a sexy acronym, but CCRTC is curiosity leads to connection. Connection develops rapport. Rapport establishes trust. Trust gains compliance. And that's what I used throughout my policing career. But in that moment, everything starts with curiosity. And I just wish that firemen would have had some insight to pull me to the side and say, hey, buddy, like, why did you set your bed on fire? Like, what's going on? What are you trying to communicate? Because I just learned this thing that, like, human behavior is actually communication. But instead of him offering me any help, he threatened me. And I saw this so often in police work with the juvenile population, kids out tagging things or doing things that they know is not right. But when you catch them, you're just berating them and going off on them. And I'm like, hold on a second. Ask them what's going on at home. Like, what's happening in their house that they're out here doing this? Because something's missing.
Joe Smarrow, thank you for joining me on the podcast, man.
Thank you, brother. Super excited to be here.
It's a pleasure to meet you. It seems like you're doing noble work, man.
Yeah, it carries many names for sure, but noble could be one of them. Yeah, I appreciate that. And just honestly really blessed to be in the position I'm in right now to be able to do the work that we're doing. Yeah, it's a great ride for sure.
I definitely want to hear what led you down that path. But first, just to give the listeners some insight of what you are doing. I mean, I watched, you were the San Antonio Police Department, their mental health unit. And I watched, I don't know if you would call it a documentary, Ernie and Joe.
Yeah.
I didn't get through the whole thing just because of schedule, but man, it was powerful stuff.
Yeah. So I would call it a documentary. And just to give Jen McShane some shout that who made that documentary, it actually won an Emmy in 2020. Nice. And then HBO bought it, or Max bought it, for 5 years. So it technically is not with them anymore because the license is up. But I know right now it is on YouTube being shown for free. So yeah, I'd love for your audience to check it out. It's Ernie and Joe Crisis Cops on YouTube.
Yeah. So are you still actively doing what you guys are portraying on that that documentary, or have you shifted gears?
Yeah. So I actually left the police department in 2020.
Okay.
And just so people know, because they're like, oh, so you make them. I didn't make the movie and I'm not a movie star. It's a documentary. I certainly didn't get paid for it. But no, I started my company in 2017. And so as a cop, a lot of cops have side hustles. And my company that I run full time now is what was the side hustle back in 2017. So we had 3 years of traction. And, you know, it was during COVID. It was post the George Floyd killing. And then things just really started getting busy. And I kind of got pushed into a hard decision of I can't keep doing both of these things well. And that I went to the department and we asked them like, hey, can we just take off the next like 6 months? And they were like, not at all. So I was like, all right. And I truly was unhappy and I'm happy to get into all the details you want to, but for probably 18 months, I had like lost the edge. I lost the excitement. I kind of dreaded going to work, which was not who I was. And honestly, a big part of that was part of the documentary and how the police chief handled all of that. I was really frustrated. And so my therapist one day, I walked in and as I did routinely, and she's like, Joe, how long is this a NC-17 podcast? Is there any cussing allowed? I want to respect your rules, Les.
You could say whatever you want.
Okay. So anyway, she's like, Joe, how long are you going to show up to these sessions and just bitch about work? And I was like, oh, forever. And she was like, yeah, not an option. And I was like, look, I've only got 15 years on. We're not fully vested until 20. We don't get a pension until 20. You know, I have four children and four children on child support, by the way, and happy to get into that. And so I was like, look, I can't just leave. I have health insurance, child support, $3,000 a month. Like, I can't just quit. And she's like, Joe, you're not going to make it 5 years. And I was terrified, man. It was super scary. And I really thought about it for a while. And I was like, okay, you know, cause as a side hustle, we were making some money, but it wasn't enough to take care of my family. And, lo and behold, she and all my mentors were right. But once I decided to leave the department and focus full time on the business, it just took off. And so it was a huge blessing, but it was certainly scary.
Yeah, I bet. Well, let's go back to when you were at the department for a bit. I mean, you mentioned your therapist. And when I was watching that show or documentary, it kind of felt like you were the therapist for intense situations. Talk a little bit about what you were doing and how this niche that you found that your skill set really suited you for.
Yeah, so not to disrespect or minimize therapist because I'm not one, but the requirement to do that in a police role is you're not diagnosing, you're not prescribing. So it really is like street intervention. And the true requirement to do that well, I would argue, is yes, the skills of being an effective communicator, knowing how to negotiate, but it really is just massive amounts of empathy and understanding human behavior. And the thing I was most proud of, Les, of my 15-year career, but specifically on the 11 years on the mental health unit, is I had over 8,465 calls with the sickest of the sick in our community in those 11 years. And I didn't have one use of force incident. That's not because of college degrees. That's purely my obsession with human behavior and my ability to empathize with the very complex and fluidly moving behavioral health community. And also I was one myself, right? I myself am a consumer from my childhood trauma, my Marine Corps combat trauma. The VA diagnosed me with PTSD and persistent depressive disorder. And so as I was helping myself, I was learning things that made me better at my job. But that didn't come until I was already on the unit for about 2 years. And I'll be honest, the first 2 years, I was a massive hypocrite. I would show up every day with the best advice and a smile and tell them just, oh, go to the doctor, take your medication, follow your treatment plan. And I myself was a disaster, going through 2-3 divorces, addicted to pornography, just a mess of a human. And one day it was my second wife was leaving me and she said, look, something's seriously wrong with you. And I was acutely suicidal. And I remember sitting in my townhouse and I was like, I either need to just die or I need to go and get help. And I'm on the, like, I am all for like education and, you know, dealing with stigma and trying to overcome stigma that exists in the mental health world. But when it came to me, a man, a Marine, a cop, and I was like, yeah, but not for me. And, what a delusion. So, once I went to the VA about 13 years ago, actually, I walked in and just, I've never stopped some form of treatment. There's been some gaps, but not huge. And even now still, I'm not a patient of the VA other than my physical stuff, but, I have a private therapist now. I just started ketamine treatment. So, and I'm happy to get into the childhood stuff of what drew me to all of this work. But truly, I became really good at this because it was, I saw myself in everyone that I was dealing with. Now, yeah, I don't have a methamphetamine addiction, or yeah, I don't have schizoaffective disorder, but I can connect with people that are at their worst moment, either floridly psychotic and unaware of where they are, or wanting to die. And then how can I just provide a little bit of light or give them a little bit of hope in that moment so that they want to at least keep trying to stay in the fight? And that just became a purpose for me. And it's something that I've continued to do.
Man, that is awesome. I know you weren't trying to brag, but I want to just get some reference here. You said you had over 8,400 calls with zero use of force.
Yep.
What's the delta there? Like, what's typical? What would someone expect as far as like what percentage of calls does lead to like a first responder, an officer, you know, leaning on his ability to use force?
Yeah, I don't want to make up numbers and embellish anything here, Les, but it's fair to say that, you know, an average police officer responding to the high level of mental health calls that have come. So there's some fluctuating data on this that I've seen everything from like 30 to 50% of 911 calls have like a mental health nexus to it. My argument's always been 100% of 911 calls have a behavioral health component because people don't call the police when their day is going well. So even if it's, I walked outside and my car was stolen, that person's going to be in a behavioral, emotional disturbance to where it's like, we have to show up and be our best selves to like lower the temperature in the room. So even if they don't have a diagnosis, it's still like these people are in a heightened state. So we need to show up and be like the level of the two minds in this situation. But I will tell you, even on patrol, before I had the training in crisis intervention training, before I joined the mental health unit, my 4.5 years on patrol or whatever it was, I probably in 4.5 years had five use of force incidents where I tased somebody. Now, again, it's slightly different because as a patrol officer, you're responding to the full spectrum. Right? Barking dogs, theft reports, missing persons, family violence, felonies, assaults, all kinds of, you know, homicides, everything. On the mental health unit, 100% of my 911 calls that I responded to were mental health calls. And so I always knew what I was going into to some degree. Now, obviously, sometimes it might be a jumper. Sometimes it'd be a barricaded subject. Sometimes they have a gun. Sometimes they have a knife. Sometimes they have no idea what's happening in the world. So the situation might change some. But at the end of the day, I knew we were dealing with a mental health component. And so there's real skills that you can utilize, which are the ones we teach now, to actually connect with people regardless of what's happening in that environment. And I just got really good at those because when you are saturated, so I tell people my tagline is police work, public safety really has, we are saturated in human suffering. And when you can thrive in that environment, when you can like normalize the chaos for other people, what might be their worst moment or their worst day, how can we show up and just be like a beacon of hope instead of an agitator or an escalator and bringing in the authority, bringing in the fear that comes with policing, bringing in all this stuff of the public's perception? How can we immediately disarm them or unarm them, which is the name of the book, right? How can we unarm them to realize like, yes, I'm here in official capacity. Yes, I'm in a uniform if I was working patrol. On the mental health unit, we're in plain clothes, as you saw in the documentary, but we're still armed, right? We still have our way to protect ourselves. But how do we address that immediately to lessen their fear if possible and then connect with them on a human level? And the first thing we would do, which is why the documentary is titled the way it is I would, every call we would show up and I'd say, hey, my name is Joe. I'm with the police department. You're not in any trouble. I'm just here to help you out. But it's not, I'm Officer Smarrow. This is official business. It's like, no, man, my name is Joe. I'm just a dude doing a job. And I want to get to know you a little bit and see what's going on and how we can help you out. And so that immediately would change the dynamics quite a bit.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, it's like such a fine line, or the energy, the approach and the tone of the voice can make all the difference for the other person, I'm sure. And then completely pivot the direction of the encounter. For selfish reasons, I'm always interested in how to get better at like dealing with, I don't know, confrontation or whatever, and being like more skillful in how I react or respond to whatever, you know, whatever saturation of suffering you think I'm in for the moment. But But I'm also always inspired by the whole theme that seems to be common on these conversations where it's like from the wound comes the gift. And you talked about, I guess you think that some of these skills that you've developed, and I'm sure you go into in your book, Unarmed, emerged out of some pain that goes back long beyond just like a couple rough marriages. You mentioned you're using different treatments, ketamine, obviously different therapists. Can we hear a little bit about that backstory and if you're comfortable talking about some of that stuff?
Yeah. So the origin story that really, and again, I'm unaware at the time, obviously, because I was seven. So, but this moment was pivotal in my life that now drives everything I do. So the long and short of it is my parents married super young, right out of high school. I have a sister who's 3 years older than me. My dad was in the Navy. We were stationed down in Norfolk, Virginia, and he was on a routine 6-month Mediterranean float just with the Navy. During that time, my mom had additional needs. And so she had an affair with another sailor, and he would come to the house frequently. He was playing dad. It was awkward and we knew something was weird, but he was there a lot. And then at some point he decided like, oh, the affair is not enough. Now I want the kid. And so he started sexually abusing me at 7 years old, and he'd come in my room at night and do things and make me do things to him. And this went on for a couple months. And at some point I told my mom, I said, hey, I don't know what this is, but Steve's come to my room and he's doing these things to me and he's making me do this stuff to him. And like, just kind of curious and confused. And her response was like, no, he's not. You don't say those things. Like, that gets people in trouble. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, what do I know? Right. Surely my mom's going to protect me. So the abuse continues. Now, I don't know the leap here, and this is where my obsession with understanding human behavior comes from now. But as a young child, I did what I thought was best. And I asked my mom for help when it wasn't received. And I want people to remember this statement, but when people do not listen to your words, their behaviors will always tell the truth. So at some point, it was a weekend. It was late morning. My sister was taking a bath. My mom was on the couch taking a nap, and she used to be a smoker. So we're on base housing. I go into my mom's purse and I grab a book of matches. I go in my bedroom, I shut the door, and I'm laying underneath my bed and I'm setting my bed on fire. I'm trying to, but I didn't realize as a kid that mattresses are flame retardant. It's brilliant. But I also, Les, this is where I tell people, like, this is when I knew I was going to be an entrepreneur, because I just didn't give up. Like, I had grit. And so I would light the fabric and it would just go out. I'd light the fabric and it would go out. But it burnt this little hole to where I could fit my tiny little hand through it. And then I was able to get to like the wood frame underneath the mattress. And so then I would hold match to that and it eventually lit. And so obviously I panic. I'm like, oh damn, I just started a fire. So I roll out from the bed. I go bang on the bathroom door. I wake up my mom, like, we got to go. There's a fire. There's a fire. And the base fire department showed up really quick. And I have no ill will to this man. I hope he had a great career in life. But, and it wasn't catastrophic, right? So it burnt my bed, it burnt the floor, and it burnt part of the wall, but it didn't burn the house down. And they put it out really quickly. But I'm standing outside, not really grasping the severity of what I had done. And this fireman came out real aggressive, like real stern. And it was my first introduction to the knife hand before I joined the Marine Corps. And he leans over and he goes, young man, like yelling at me. He's like, if you ever start another fire again, you will spend the rest of your life in prison. Do you understand me? And I was like, whoa, prison. Like, oh my God. And I'm hugging my mom. I'm like, mom, I don't want to go to prison. I'm sorry. Like, I'm sorry. And I was just terrified. And in hindsight now, this is why my passion for training first responders, but not just, right? It's people, parents. Your kids are going to do dumb shit. And if you punish them, if the response to any time your kid does something that you don't agree with is to punish them or sanction the behavior, all you're doing is pushing them further away from you. Because if you're not curious as to what's causing that behavior, you're missing a massive opportunity. And so I wish in hindsight that fireman would have had the insight or our training that didn't exist at the time to, and I'll walk through our model here later for you, Les, but our de-escalation protocol is CCRTC. It's not a sexy acronym, but CCRTC is curiosity leads to connection. Connection develops rapport. Rapport establishes trust. Trust gains compliance. And that's what I use throughout my policing career. But in that moment, everything starts with curiosity. And I just wish that fireman would have had some insight to pull me to the side and say, hey, buddy, like, why did you set your bed on fire? Like, what's going on? What are you trying to communicate? Because I just learned this thing that like human behavior is actually communication. But instead of him offering me any help, he threatened me. And I saw this so often in police work with the juvenile population, kids out tagging things or doing things that they know is not right. But when you catch them, you're just berating them and going off on them. And I'm like, hold on a second. Ask them what's going on at home. Like, what's happening in their house that they're out here doing this? Because something's missing. And that's how I always led in policing, which again, gave me the success that I had. And now even to run my company today. But because that situation, my mom and Steve weren't smart enough to realize like, oh, Joey set his bed on fire because of what I'm doing to him. So I'm just going to keep doing it. He's just a bad kid. And so the abuse continued. At some point, my sister calls our grandmother, my father's mom up in New York, and tells her what's happening. This is like 1989. She calls my dad, tells him what's going on. He gets leave to fly home. And then all hell broke loose. The way he responded to that wasn't favorable. He ended up getting kicked out of the military. So in a 96-hour window, my dad learned his wife cheated on him, his kid's been molested, and he just got pushed out of the military and lost his career. So we move up to New York. I didn't go to school my third grade year. I was in therapy 3 days a week, play therapy. I was in court. Mom's fighting for custody. She had no chance. And then my dad just became a raging alcoholic. And I can't imagine what he was going through, but he definitely used me to take out his anger. And so then for 8 years, I just endured violence from him and we had no relationship. He never showed up for anything school related, none of my sports. And at 15 years old, because he had three girlfriends after my mom, and all of them were physically abusive and he was abusive. And at 15, I walk in the house. It's like 3 p.m. coming home from school. My dad's at work. The house reeks of weed. My stepmom's having very loud, audible sex with somebody, not my dad. And I'm like, what the hell is happening? And I'm starting to become more aware of the world. And that night I decided to confront my dad and I was like, hey man, I said, you know, Alex is having sex with some guy while you're working. And he was like, yeah, I kind of figured, you know, we haven't been together in months. She just got nowhere to go. And I hated this woman. And I was like, I'm not doing this anymore. I was like, I'm leaving. He's like, no, you're not. I was like, no, I promise you I am. And I did. I just got some stuff and started staying with friends, just staying away from my house as much as I could. And nobody cared. Like he didn't come looking. No one cared. I just avoided home at all cost. And my girlfriend, 9th grade, 10th grade, 11th grade, finally my junior year, her parents took me in and they're like, hey man, I don't know what's going on, but just come stay with us for a little while. And I was like, finally. And this is a joke, Les, but it's a true story. I was playing sports. It was like my safety net. It was the only thing that kept me going. I hated school. I truly thought I was a dumb person. My grades were terrible, but I had no accountability. I had no oversight. No one was like making sure I was doing homework except my coaches just to make sure I could play in the game. And so I so badly wanted to thank my girlfriend's parents for like giving me some stability. But my joke is I didn't have a job and I didn't have money. And so I'm like, what can I give them to extend my gratitude? And then I was like, oh, I know, I'm going to get their daughter pregnant. 0 out of 10 recommend that for high schoolers. So I became a father my senior year of high school because of being irresponsible, because of being a dumb kid. I love my daughter. She's 25 now and doing well. But that's why I joined the Marine Corps. It was straight out of necessity. It wasn't out of patriotism. It was like, oh, damn, I have a kid. Going to college is not an option for me right now. I have to take care of my family. And that was in 2000. So then 9/11 happens. And now I'm finding myself fighting a war when I'm like, I just wanted to take care of my daughter. What the hell's happened to my life? And that kind of became the theme of like safety, survival, being a passenger in my own life, just being a victim to my circumstances, never taking ownership until I decided to walk into the VA many years later, obviously, where it was like, now I truly live my life this way, which is everything is my fault. Everything is my fault. If things are going well in my life, it's because of things I'm doing. If things are not going well, it's because of the things I'm not doing. Nobody outside of me gets any more power over me. That's the news, the media, the president, and people can call this privilege all they want. It's not privilege. It's mindset. And I take full ownership for my existence because that's the ultimate freedom to me. And those moments drove everything that my curiosity in people, my obsession with behavior, my understanding of mental health, like how to like really connect with someone when they are in that dark place. But also it's like lead from the front, do the work yourself. Don't just these leaders through lips, right? That they just say all these things, but you know that their whole life is a disaster. I don't want to be that anymore. And so if I'm going to go through a modality or a treatment and it's working for me, I'm going to take the things that I think are beneficial. And now I'm going to share that with people, not like telling them what they need to do, but just sharing my own experiences of what I'm doing, things that help me. And maybe it will help someone else if they choose to do that. And I just feel like I'm a living permission slip, especially for men that feel like they're unable to emote, they're unable to express themselves verbally, and that the only two emotions that exist are either I'm fine, happy, or I'm angry. And it's binary. And I just totally disagree with that. And which is why my next book is called The 12 Laws of Maximizing the Human Experience. And it's like, how can we maximize the human experience? And that's what I feel like I'm truly here to do, maximize the human experience I have, and then be a permission slip for other people to live their best life as well.
Holy shit, Joe. I have to be careful what I ask for, man. I might just get it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I had a plan of things to ask you on this, but
we're going,
man,
off the sheet
that
now.
Is fucking gut wrenching. What a story.
Thank you, brother. Yeah. I mean, and because I think it matters real quick, my favorite quote that I live by, and I've got many actually, but because it resonates here is, I have learned to become grateful for the things I wish never happened. Truly, like, what a blessing. And I see it now as, yeah, I wish I was never sexually abused. I wish I was never physically abused. I wish I had a great relationship with my family. But you know what? I'm not the only one that's been in those situations. And so now I've reframed it to gratitude. And what a gift, as you mentioned, it was like a wound to now a blessing, is like, what a gift that I've had these experiences. So now I can connect with a very diverse audience and maybe give them hope through whatever they're going through.
I think there's infinite hope that's out there that can be kindled or manifested from this message. Well, first, I just want to thank you and I guess applaud you for the vulnerability it takes to
thank you, brother,
to do what you just did, to just lay thank it you. Out there. And that is character. I mean, as an American, it's like, yeah, that's what you want your Marines to be able to do. Like, that is a different type of strength that is probably in general just lacking, especially in the male sex of this society now.
You know? It's so funny you say that, because we often, I talk about this in our training, but I'm like, what comes to mind when you think of toughness? We think of like physical characteristics, right? Rambo and CrossFitters and bodybuilders. And we think of physical characteristics. And a lot of men, because you brought up strength, and I'm totally aligned with you on that, Les. Like, no, to me, like, cool, you can bench 250 pounds. Awesome. But are you willing to like share with somebody how you're actually feeling today? That to me is real strength. And I'll be honest, recently, because I put myself out there in my social media, I put myself out there and I get some guys that will troll me and they're like, why are you selling feminism? That is not what men need to do. The only therapy that works for men is a squat rack in the woods. You know, they don't need therapy. Women die in therapy. And I'm like, what a terrible, terrible take. And that's the mindset of, and this specific person happens to be a military veteran as well. And I'm like, man, like with a lot of empathy, but I'm like, you are the worst type of veteran in my opinion, because that mindset is dangerous. And again, I'm not saying working out is not good for you. It's great for you. As you know, Les, as owning a gym, you know, it's good for you. That's a piece of it. But if you're not processing trauma, there's no amount of squatting that's going to just make your life get better and deal with the things that were dealt to you. And so it's important to me that we have these various modalities that exist, because it's not the same for everyone. Maybe cognitive behavioral therapy doesn't work for somebody, but maybe EMDR does. You know, again, as I've told you, I started ketamine, which has been a beautiful thing for me. Like, I'm so glad it's FDA approved. I'm so glad that we're actually able to prescribe it now, but there's still a lot of stigma around it, right? Like, oh, psychedelics, like, uh-oh, you're using drugs. And it's like, well, yes. And it's incredibly beneficial for me. And so I'm going to continue to do it until I get what I need from it. So I have no shame in it. And to me, the real toughness, here's how I define toughness in two parts. The first is insight to know something is coming up, something's off. The second part is super hard. And then it's the courage to actually do something about it, to voice it, to say it out loud, to tell somebody. That to me is what toughness really is. And I find it massively lacking in society today.
Yeah, for sure. You know, something I, you know, when I hear like the person that commented that you referenced saying that, you know, that was like weak or feminism or whatever, I mean, it's the same thing. Like, it takes a sense of empathy or compassion, like something my wife taught me a while ago, is like when you see someone doing something that you feel is like not the right thing for someone to be doing, a great question is like, I wonder what happened to them.
Yes.
I wonder what happened. That's so like that person curiosity. Also has, yeah, exactly, has something that happened to them and he just hasn't made it down the path you have yet, yep. You know, and yep. Not that that's a knock on them. It's just that like everybody goes on, you know, you can only do the best you can in any moment with the tools that you have, and that there's a cumulative momentum to your life where every moment you have is built on all the previous moments and you can't pull from what you haven't experienced or learned from. You mentioned modalities and you just referenced the ketamine. Can you elaborate on like what you think that particular modality has done for you?
Yeah. So it's honestly been the hardest thing for me to describe. Because in therapy, you're working through a specific modality. And like, again, cognitive behavioral therapy is essentially like how your thoughts influence your behaviors. So it's very simple. It's thoughts, emotions, and actions. That's really what it is. And so it's easy to talk through that stuff, right? Like it was so fascinating for me over a decade when I was learning like, oh, everything that I'm doing as an adult, there's like this string that's tied to the childhood self of me, right? So it's not that this is, you know, 40-year-old Joe that's having this response. This is 9-year-old Joey that wasn't getting a need met. So understanding that was really beneficial for me. Honestly, what ketamine, and I'm 6 journeys into this, this program, and what it genuinely feels like, and I'm not embellishing here, but my month and a half of doing this, it feels like 10 years of therapy in a month's time. And because here's what I believe. Now, I come into this with a lot of insight already. And they've told me that I'm using a company called Anywhere Clinic and they're phenomenal. But they tell me often, like, you have so much insight, which is great because now there's so much less like unpacking to do. And so they send the ketamine to your house, which originally I was like, whoa, that's wild. But the idea behind it is when you go into a sterile medical clinic, right? And you're in someone else's environment, you're already a little uncomfortable. And then they do either a nasal spray or the trochee or an injection. You're in another environment. It's going to be hard for you because the two most important pieces of ketamine treatment are set and setting. So set your intentions. What is it that you want this to do? What do you want the medicine to reveal? What are you hoping for? And then setting is your environment. So the fact that I get to do this in my bed is incredible. And I put a blindfold on and I put my noise canceling headphones. They send me a music playlist, which is phenomenal. And I have one for healing. I have one for growing. I have one for love and I have one for transcending. And so based on whatever I'm working through, I'll use that playlist and I'm doing the trochees. And so it's sublingual. You just put it in your mouth, let it absorb for 20 minutes. But here's what's super important. Breath work. Doing breath work before, doing some meditation before, journaling before, getting your mind right. Then put on your blindfold, put on your AirPods or whatever. Take the medicine, just put it under your tongue, let it absorb 20 minutes. Spit it out in your cup. You don't absorb it. The only people that truly need to absorb it scientifically are people dealing with chronic pain issues. There's really no additional benefit to ingesting it other than chronic pain, which I don't have. So I'm like, okay, I'll spit it out. And I went from 50 milligrams to 100 to 300 to 400 just to go into like a deeper journey. But here's what I love about it. Whether you do 50 milligrams or 800 milligrams, your journey only lasts 1 hour. Right? So 45 to 60 minutes, you're out of it. And what happens when you're in it is the medicine takes you wherever it's going to take you. And here's what I have found though, is it has all been just incredibly loving and blissful and joyous. Even when it gets a little dark and heavy, it just gives me so much perspective. Every time I come out of it, I'm like, what are we doing? Like the world is just one massive distraction. And if we could just simplify it, like this journey, and it's 45 to 60 minutes, but it feels like you're gone for 6 to 8 hours. And cause your mind is just going to so many places and like, you know, you're dissociating a little bit. It's like I'm playing scenes out in my mind. A lot of repressed memories from my childhood were coming up, which are good. I mean, they're terrible memories, right. But it's good that they're coming to the surface. And then the thing for people to understand is The ketamine is not about the high. It's not about the journey. It's not about those 60 minutes. What it is about is the subsequent 48 hours, because now your brain is malleable. Your neuroplasticity is like wired, ready to go. It's primed. And that's where the real work happens. That's where you do your integration coaching. That's where you're doing your therapy. That's where it's like reaffirming, what new beliefs do you want? What new patterns do you want? Like, what stories do you want?
Are you doing that with someone?
Yes. Okay. It's with this clinic, Anywhere Clinic. So they have an integration coach, and then they have a psychiatrist, and it's been phenomenal. Like, truly, it has been a game changer for me to go to this next level of care, because it's bringing up so much old stuff, but it's also reframing my perspective on life. And it's like all this stuff, the media, TV, news, wars, like those are all real things, but do we really need to like overconsume it and distract ourselves by it and divide over it and have the left and the right and have the us and the them? And it's like, no, man, like we really are on the same journey, just trying to maximize the human experience. And yet there seems to be a lot of fear and hate and stuff that just divides us. And that like breaks my heart.
But so it's like the body, the inner wisdom knows what you need to revisit, and the chemical is just getting all the fight or resistance out of the way so yes, that it could arise. That's
yes. Like in meditation, which you're familiar with, right? You know about the monkey mind. And so you're observing thoughts, but the goal is to not grasp them. It's just to observe them and release them. This is like the deepest, greatest form of meditation. Because it's not that you're not having a bunch of thoughts. You are. You're having visuals. You're having thoughts. But they're lucid. And you're aware. Like, it's not like if I lifted up my blindfold, I know I'm in my bedroom. I'm safe. Like, they tell you have to have a trip sitter, which is my wife. So she's in the house. But the biggest threat, like the biggest danger that they have with ketamine is while you're in it for that 60 minutes, if you're like, uh-oh, I have to go pee. Well, you're so high on this medicine that you can't walk well. Like even when I come out of it after an hour, when I get up slowly, it's like I'll hold the wall just to go out to the living room to get some light, sit in my recliner. But for the next 30 to 60 minutes, like you have to be very careful walking. And then by 2 hours, you're totally fine. Like I drive, I go back, I take meetings, like I'm just right back to myself within a couple hours. But then I know I've got 2 days to do the work, to like think through stuff, to like try to reprogram the mind and leverage the neuroplasticity so that I can create these new neural networks that, because here's how it's described beautifully. When we experience trauma in your neural pathway, it's like a pothole. And so the brain is incredibly efficient. So it's like, hey, we're not going to go through this pothole. That's damaging. We're going to create a detour. So we're just going to go around that pothole. What ketamine does is it essentially fills those potholes. And so now it's like, no, we want to go back to this, but we're going to create this old road that was here that no longer is. We're going to show you that we can go through this as we fill the pothole to help you process this. And we're going to give you the ability neurochemically so that you can do this, but you have to do it with a trusted partner, a coach, a therapist to help you in those integration sessions afterwards.
That's cool. That what a great analogy. I've never heard that one. I'll probably be stealing that one, Joe.
Take it. No, I stole it from my wife has a podcast as well. And she just had a psychiatrist on her podcast.
What's the name of her podcast?
It's called Unblocked with Jessica Smorrow. And so, yeah, she had the psychiatrist on there and she's the one that gave that analogy because she prescribes ketamine and was like, yeah, it fills the potholes. And I was like, oh, I love that. So, yeah.
So I didn't think we were going to be talking about ketamine today, but I have a couple more questions. So when you're in it, and under the influence of the medicine, I guess, and you have, let's say something from the past come up, let's say some moment of that things weren't good. Your 9-year-old self appears. Are you able to, or invited to, or do you feel the need or desire to like, are you interacting with that younger self? Are you like, I see you, I'm here for you, you're okay. Or are you just like an observer and then connecting dots of like, oh, that's why I behave like I do because that happened to me. Or
Yep. It's definitely more the latter for me so far. I've heard people, even my integration coach, he has ingested at higher levels. Again, when you ingest, you're going to almost have two journeys, but that's where they talk about like death of ego. He was telling me that he experienced hell and heaven in one journey, because when you ingest higher dosages, for those that don't know, like our brain is powerful, but really for every signal your brain sends, your gut sends 9 more to your brain. So you've got like your whole second brain in your gut. And so when you ingest it, the medicine's now going down into the gut and it's going to create a very different response, a way more drastic one. I have not done that yet. I told them, I'm curious. I'm like, I really kind of want to, because I just want to know. But they're like, look, you can, like, there's no harm in doing it, but just know that like the hangover effect is going to last hours. Like my integration coach says that, for like 12 to 16 hours, he's in that kind of like loopy state where he's like, I can't drive. I can't do meetings. Like I'm essentially worthless. And I'm like, oh yeah, I'm way too busy to do that. Maybe I could block out a day one time and do it. But I'm also like, if there really is no scientific benefit of ingesting it, then I can kill that curiosity and not, I still might, but they talk me out of it because it's like, yeah, I don't want to be kind of loopy for 12 hours. But there is a part of me, because I've talked to people that are like, yeah, I interacted with my childhood self. I was validating him and saying, hey, it's going to be okay. Like we're going to get through this. I know you're not receiving the love you need in this moment, but here's the great news. And you're like having conversations. I have not had that. I've just been observing. Repressed memories are surfacing. And I'm like, oh, I forgot about that. Oh, I wonder why that came up. And then afterwards, when I'm back to my full aware state, I will reflect on it and just say like, okay, why did that come up to me? You're either journaling on it or you're writing it down. You're telling your coach about it, your therapist, and then they're helping you like work through it. Again, the why, the how, the what. And in that moment is where now it's like, okay, what would you want to tell your younger self in that moment? Now you're doing it from a more lucid place, but I haven't had the like hallucination effect of like having a conversation with myself. It interests me. I just haven't, I haven't had that level yet.
I've done a bunch of psychedelics over the, over my lifetime, I guess. And, I've never done ketamine, but I have found like with cannabis, surprisingly, the effect profile from digesting that is quite different than the other methods. And that is where I've had some surprisingly powerful, I'm sure it's like a, you know, different sensation, but like powerful effects as far as revisiting old stuff and working through it and been able to do things like, not like interact back and forth, but definitely convey to my younger self a message that as my older self, I can try to provide, and then it somehow patch up or heal that younger self that's still like stuck in me somewhere. And it'd be some kind of like pivot point on my own, you know, emotional healing and also having a physical healing, like coordinated, like physical component to go with it. That's fascinating to me. I have one other question on this, then I want to get into the whole, like the process of the unarming. So you say you're opening up the like neuroplasticity, if you will, from the chemical interaction with, I guess, the brain, nervous system or whatever. However, I doubt we understand it all fully what's going on there. But, and then you have this 48-hour window. Is that, how are you like, what's the modality you're using to walk through how you want to view, and now this more lucid mindset, these things that came up during the session?
Yeah. So my biggest struggle still as a 43-year-old man, I'll be 44 this weekend. My biggest struggle is fear of abandonment, insecurities. And, the way that has manifested in my life is because that's been heavy for me. And this isn't an excuse. Again, I take ownership, but for a good 9 years when I was on the police department, so my first year on the job, I had an in custody death. A guy punched me in the face. He was on a ton of cocaine. Nothing came off my belt, taser, pepper spray, baton, nothing. We basically did jujitsu for 7.5 minutes before cover showed up. It was right at shift change, terrible timing. And it took 4 of us guys to get him into handcuffs. And as soon as we handcuffed him, he died. So that to me, cause I got out of the Marine Corps cause I was tired of being around death, causing death. It was terrible. So now, as a cop, 1 year in, I have my in custody death, and I'm like, damn, man. And I just lost it. Became suicidal more than not, very depressed, developed an addiction for pornography, drinking just to try to sleep. And I used my vice, my drug was women. And as a man that was so insecure and truly hated myself and believed I had no worth, it was easy for me to seek validation from some woman that would fawn over me or be like, oh my God. And I'm like, cool. Let me now chase this to get that dopamine. Let me pursue this just to have sex, to immediately then hate myself, but also to then validate that there's nothing like beautiful about relationships. Everybody's on the take. It didn't matter if they're married or not. Like, I mean, I was very, very, you know, out of control at that time, and I'm not proud of it at all. But I own the fact that I made those mistakes. But I also now understand why I was doing it so easily. And the thing I still work through to this day as a guy that's married is if my wife like has a meeting or she leaves and she's like at a social function or a mixer or whatever networking event, I cannot help my brain from coming up with this thought of like, oh, here it is. She's going to leave. She's going to find Mr. right now. She's on the take. She's going to be gone. And everything in me wants to like sabotage, because what I was doing before was like, oh, I'm protecting myself. I'm going to cheat on my spouse, make them find out about it. They're then going to leave me, which validates my own story. And it was just a loop of self-sabotage. And because then when they would leave, I'd be like, you see, I knew you were going to leave me. And they're like, well, yeah, because of what you did. I'm like, no, you were going to do it anyway. And it was just this horrible, vicious pattern that I was doing. So now when I do my ketamine, it's like in those 48 hours, I'm trying really hard to think through like, okay, so how can I feel safe when my spouse does this thing? How can I, what story could I find or what evidence could I look for that believing truly that there's no proof that this has happened before, that she hasn't done this. So like, why would she do it now? And can I find moments where I'm like, no, I do believe she loves me, even though everything in my mind is like, hey, be careful, all that fear-based stuff, the childhood stuff, the mom not protecting me, dad treating me terribly, every relationship being toxic and terrible, everybody essentially leaving and walking out of my life. The story I have is that I'm a worthless person, that my self-worth is so low that I'm not worth staying around for. I'm not worth fighting for. And if anybody actually ever got to know the real full version of me, which is honestly why I'm so candid, because I'm like, look, you don't have power against me because I'm just going to put it out there, is like, if anyone truly knew who I was fully, they would just leave. And that's the thing I try really hard to overcome is like, what if I, because it was like, I don't believe in love. I don't think love is real. I don't think relationships last. And so now it's like, how do I love myself? How can I show up for myself? And if I'm not willing, and I think this is an important point, and this came from the ketamine session that I had recently, like 2 weeks ago, is when I'm talking to him about this and he asked me, and it frustrated me because he was like, well, how do you love yourself? And I was like, why would you ask me such an offensive question? And I didn't have an answer. And I was like, I don't know, man, I play a lot of golf. And he's like, well, I'm glad you have hobbies, but like, how do you love yourself? And he's like, what's interesting, Joe, is you want your spouse to love you, but you've never demonstrated how you love yourself. So how is anyone else going to love you if you don't love yourself? And I was like, whoa. So now like, that's the next hurdle for me is show up for myself, love myself so that I can project and demonstrate what I expect in return or how I expect to be treated. Because right. If I do dumb things, I expect to be treated poorly. That's just the, we'll call it karma or whatever. But that's been my battle right now. And in those 48 hours, I just started IFS. I don't know if you're familiar with that. The internal family systems. That's been huge for me. Maps of consciousness from Dr. David Hawkins. I just bought that book. And we work through the map of consciousness now of working up the ladder. And I'm like, whoa, this is really, really fascinating for me because it gives me a real framework that I can work through when it's like, okay, I'm feeling fear. So then now how do I work up? How do I pull myself up from fear? And you just work the steps of that map of consciousness. And it's been incredible. We're a few weeks into this. I'm not going to say it's perfect. Admittedly, last night we went to an event together and I'm with her and I see her chatting with a couple guys, you know, and she has a business too. She's networking. She's whatever. Right. But I just witness her talking to these two guys. And right away, my mind is like, uh-oh, we're in danger. Something bad is going to happen. We have to get out of here. And it is so uncomfortable for me. And I hate it because then the story is, see, I'm not fixed. I'm not healed. My wife, just being who she is, threatens who I am. And so this is never going to work. I don't know why I'm married. I should never be in a relationship. And all these like thoughts just creep in and it's really, really hard to work through.
Wow. That's crazy. Well, I wish you luck on learning how to love yourself, Joe.
I'm trying.
I can attest to the fact that it's fucking hard. And I've been working on it myself a long time. I have a history of, you know, I would say different types of childhood trauma and such that led to, you know, lack of self-worth, self-sabotage and such. And sometimes I feel like I'm doing it. And I'll even say it. But then a part of me, I was like, oh, you're full of shit. You think you're just, it's like a fucking costume you're wearing that you love yourself. It's really, really hard. And now, like, even as a parent, I'll see things in my kids and it's like, there's nothing more I want to be able to convey to them is to learn how to love themselves. And I don't know if anybody really comes out of the gate, out of at least adolescence, really 100% being secure in who they are and, you know, where they fit in the world and such. And, you know, that's just part of the human experience. I mean, the Buddhists have it right when they say life is suffering, you know, we are all saturated as well in it in some form or another. But I was, you know,
the great Dr. Susan David says the price of admission for a life well lived is suffering.
There you go. Yeah, that's really well said.
And just to touch that point real quick too, Les, is the reason, and I agree with you, I don't think anyone in adolescence gets out with like full self-love and worth. The system is set up against that. And this is one of my many issues with public education is we put these kids into a external seeking validation system where it's like your worth is based on your grades. And some kids just aren't good at school. Some kids aren't good at studying. Some kids don't have the home environment or the food nutrition to have the energy to show up their best selves and retain what's happening. So if you fail a test, suddenly now you're labeled as a not smart person. And something as a parent, because you brought that up, I think is so important for any parent is when your kids come home seeking your approval or saying, are you proud of me? Immediately redirect that to them and say, look, are you proud of yourself? Did you put in the effort to get that result? And if you're proud of yourself, that's what matters. Like, I'm going to love you unconditionally, right? I'm going to love you unconditionally. And I don't want you to seek that validation from me because the sooner you can find it in yourself, knowing I worked hard at this project, I put myself out there, I put the effort in, and I got the result. That's all me. Awesome. And it's not about arrogance, right? It's not self-serving, but it's learning. The sooner we can learn that we are fully resourced. This is what I'm learning with ketamine. It's like every solution you're looking for in your life is already within you. You just have to heal, undo, fix. It's like my previous therapist of 7 years, she told me, she goes, Joe, every skill you developed to survive childhood, which is the whole point. Every kid in this world, all they're trying to do truly is survive it. And everything, every system you set up to survive your childhood life was awesome because it worked. You're alive. The problem is those systems no longer serve you as an adult male now. And as an adult human, those systems don't serve you. So now we have to unlearn. Now we have to relearn. Now we have to learn new, all new systems that are going to serve us for this portion of our life, because you're still reverting back to that childhood survival mechanism, which doesn't serve us today. And which is why I'm an advocate of therapy, good therapy for everybody. It's like, learn these things, learn these skills that I've spent a lot of money in therapy. I could get it free at the VA, but I just found a really, really good trauma therapist. And I paid her a lot of money over 7 years, but it was the greatest investment I ever made for myself, was showing up for myself, paying the money to learn these things so that I hopefully wouldn't continue to repeat old patterns.
Right. And that starts with awareness, where you need to just shine a light on it and then work from there. It's funny you mentioned a moment ago, like the unconditional love you have for a kid. Sometimes I feel like, you know, you don't really know what love is until you're a parent and you realize you love something more than yourself. And it's like, it's almost like your kids on some level are here to teach you how to love yourself, because they force you to love, like you love them. It's like, that's hardwired. And then in time, like they teach you enough where you could start to work on yourself.
Yeah.
And, crazy process. And I think that's like a common thread, that like that whole system or cycle might be like literally part of our hardwiring. That's something that we just have to go through.
Yeah, and for those that are choosing to not have children, I don't want you to feel like you're lost causes, because here's what I have learned, and I believe this, is the greatest value of a relationship, whether it's a marriage or intimate partner or whatever, but a significant other acts as a mirror into yourself. So if I had no insight, I could just see my wife as the problem. How dare her go and do this thing and talk to these guys in front of me? Like, how disrespectful. I could have all this narrative. So the easy thing would be like, I'll just get rid of her. Then I don't have to worry about that. The problem is that just, we refer to trauma as like splinters. And if I just get rid of her, that just puts a Band-Aid over the splinter. It doesn't heal anything. So the blessing, the reframe is like, thank God that I have a wife who continues to expose me to these trauma wounds that I still have to heal. And that is an expression of love where, again, she's not taking advantage of it. She's not doing it like, oh, watch this. I'll show him, right? She's just being herself. But if I didn't have a relationship, I wouldn't even be aware of the wounds that I had, because it wouldn't be expressed. If we didn't have children, we wouldn't be aware of this like true, deep, unconditional love where it's like, look, that is a human form of me, and my DNA is in this person, and all I want is the best for them. Like you said, it's hardwired. It's almost easy, even though some people get it very wrong. And to the point you made earlier with people not being resourced or doing the best they can with what they have, even some parents that come from lives like I did, my thing was like, okay, I know not to abuse them. I know not to talk mean at them. I know not to sexually assault them. Like, yeah, that's, I got it. But I didn't know. In fact, this is a real situation with my daughter, because I have one daughter and three sons, and I feel terrible about this. But my daughter, when she was like 7, 8 years old, around the time of my biggest wounds, she would just want to love on dad and cuddle me. And I was so physically uncomfortable, and I would prevent it. I'm like, I wouldn't tell her, don't touch me, but I would like create a situation or I'd get away. And so when I saw her at 15 and 16 years old, making poor choices and seeking approval from these not great dudes. And I'm like, I messaged her one time and I was like, hey, Lex, this is a kind of a funny story quickly, but it's like, I was away on a job traveling and I see her Instagram story, something about love and worth. And like, she was heartbroken over something. And all I messaged her was, I said, hey, I said, Lex, please know that, because I was never the father you needed me to be growing up, does not diminish my love for you. And my biggest fear is that you're going to settle for a man not worthy of you because I was never the father you needed me to be. She immediately texts me like, Dad, are you okay? And I was like, yeah, I'm fine. I'm reaching out to you. And she's like, no, promise me you're okay. So I FaceTimed her and I'm like laughing. She's freaked out. She's like, I thought you were suicidal. And I'm like, I'm trying to connect with you. But like, and I was like, this is another example of what a failure I've been as a father to you, because I'm trying to love on you, but it's so foreign that you thought I was giving you my last rights. Like, no, I'm worried about you because I wasn't the man you needed me to be growing up. Now, I've done better with my sons because I've learned more. My daughter's 25, my youngest boy's 13. I've learned a lot in those years. And I've told her, I know you see me being a different father for the boys, but it's only because I know better now. But I'm here now. I love you. But it's hard, right? When those child wounds are there, now you have to work through them to undo them. And so I'm aware of like the damage I've caused in my own children as well, by me not being fully resourced at that time and believing that, like, cause I just felt so dirty and like bad about her wanting to cuddle me. I'm like, no, you're a child. Like, you're an 8, 9 year old child. You don't need to cuddle your father. What's wrong with you? But because of my own stuff that I hadn't fully worked through. And so it's a terrible reality in my world, but it's just the feelings that I didn't know how to do it well.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great story. I mean, it's everywhere. I mean, even like you're talking, I was thinking about earlier when you were mentioning your dad's reaction to hearing the news, like, and I don't want this to come up. I'm not like diminishing anything, the weight of what you discussed, but I could imagine it in his shoes, like the shame or guilt that he would feel for allowing these things to happen to his son. And that probably played a big role in his like poor, like maladaptive reaction to all that. Like, how does a parent not feel responsible for that? And what does that do to yourself? Where, you know, so it's like there's this interconnected web that we have in every relationship we have, where there's all these these things. It's just crazy. Like, it's like it's a blessing and a curse. Like, you look out in the, you know, I look out my window here and there's wildlife out there, and it's like, they don't have all this shit. Like, they have all these, they don't do, like, we are, the fact that we, like, store and bottle things up and, like, create narratives about our experience is, like, can be so beautiful. And, man, is it make, like, yeah, obstacles in every direction, yeah, you look. You know, the you know, my dogs just shake it off if it was so easy.
Constant and immediate forgiveness, yeah.
Yeah. I want to touch a little bit, at least. I keep kicking the can here, but unarmed, de-escalation techniques to cultivate courage, compassion, and connection. Obviously, we all, anyone listening to this now, has a pretty good insight of how you have developed the ability to write a book like this, so that when you can show up on a scene, you can, you know, instead you can move away from force, if you will. And you mentioned that you have like a template. I don't know if I have this right, but CCRTC. Did I say that?
Rolls right off the tongue.
Can you touch on these a little bit? We already alluded to the curiosity of like what, you know, what's going on. What's the sequence here about?
Yeah. So the first thing is curiosity, which I break this in two parts, which is forcing yourself immediately to slow down and ask your brain what else could be true, right? Because our mind deceives us, as we just talked about. We create narratives. And especially in public safety, where it's like, oh, I already know this person. I know this address. I've been out here before. And it's like, okay, yes, that's information, but slow down. Because when we respond based on historical data only, we're preventing them from having a current moment. So when we say start with curiosity, it's what else could be true? And then it's focus on the person, not the problem. And in public safety, where a lot of people have become frustrated and jaded and callous to the work, the thing I tell them, and it's a lot of P's, but I say, if you are someone that's become frustrated with people's problems, it's because you've lost perspective. People's problems are what give us permission to have our purpose. If people didn't have problems, what the hell would we be doing? So focus on the person, not the problem. And what else could be true? That's curiosity in a nutshell. Then it goes to connection. So connection is all about reciprocity. It's relationship building. That's why my name is Joe, not Officer Smarrow, right? What is their name? Use their name. Connect with them on a human level. Focus on the person. What I call a situational autopsy. Hey, what's been going on in the last 72 hours, right? Or tell me your story. Just like you asked me, like, Joe, let's go back a little bit. Like, what's driving? I would do that with people. Like, hey, I want to know your story. I'm going to give you time, the greatest resource that we have that never comes back, but I'm going to give you my time to genuinely be curious and ask you about what's going on in your life so that I can connect with you. And also, if you ask me a question, I'm never going to shield away from it. If you're like, well, what do you know? Are you even married? Oh, we're not here to talk about me. I just want to help you. Wrong answer. They're looking to see if you're a human being. And so I would answer all kinds of questions. I mean, I would be very candid on police calls. You know, I remember in the documentary, actually, I'm not sure if you got to this point or not, but a guy was struggling. He was acutely suicidal. He went to Academy Sports, bought a gun, bought ammo, went to a strip club, wanted to burn through all of his money to have a good time before he went to his car to kill himself. So we intervene while he's at the strip club because he was doing his text goodbyes, and pull him outside. And he's like, yeah, man, I just don't get it. Like, the one woman that I crave and desire and want treats me like absolute garbage. And his father was on scene. His work boss was on scene. So people clearly cared about him, but he's like, I don't care about any of that. I want the one person who hates me the most. And I'm like, my brother, I could give you an hour long talk on this. Like, I love to attract women that hate me because it just validates my own beliefs. And so that's connection, is like humanizing that interaction. Then we got rapport. Rapport is a whole, it's essentially understanding the framework of crisis negotiation, hostage negotiation. And there's a framework called MORPI, and it's the 7-step framework of effective communication and active listening. And so MORPI is minimal encouragers, open-ended questions, reflective mirroring, emotional label, paraphrase, I message, and effective pause. You don't use it in that order, but those are the 7 skills to master communication. It's a chapter in the book. I break it down. And also, real quick plug, for anyone that gets the book, if you go like 3 pages in, there's a QR code, and We have some of our content online. That's a $97 course that we charge people to buy. You get it for free when you buy the book at 19 bucks or whatever it is. So you just scan the QR code. It takes you right to the video of me teaching active listening. That's the whole R of the CCRTC model. So we're teaching you how to effectively communicate. From there is trust. Trust is all about testing. And this is really understanding human behavior. So even as parents, like if you want your kid to do something they're likely not going to want to do, you can either A, make them do it because you're the authoritative figure and just tell them, like, I don't give a shit how you feel. Just go cut the yard. And they're like, I don't want to. Just cut the yard. I'm not going to tell you again. That's one approach. Or you can quickly develop trust and see where they're at. And that's by testing how malleable is their behavior in that moment. Hey, buddy, you mind just coming here for a minute? Get them to stand up off the couch and come over to the kitchen. They showed you in that moment that they're responding to your request. It's a small request, right? It doesn't have to be the big thing first. And this is when cops are like, I know I have to take this person to jail. I know they have warrants. I know I'm going to arrest them. Don't just show up and be like, you're under arrest. They're going to freak out. Work with them first. Like, hey, walk over here with me 5 feet. And then thank them. Hey, I appreciate you coming over and talking to me. I just want to get away from some of those people. Get them to stand up. Get them to sit down. I'm gauging how much they trust me, because if they don't trust me at all, they're not going to do anything that I want them to do. And if they're not going to do the small thing, they're sure as hell not going to do the big thing. And so once the opening scene of the documentary, Les, if you remember, we respond to the courtroom. There's a guy in there. His name's Keith. He's floridly psychotic. We know he's on meth. He's got a pen. He's pacing around. He's paranoid. He thinks people are trying to kill him. Everything about that was on purpose. Everything. I started out with a ton of distance. And then I'm like, all right, I'm going to close ground because I want to see if he retreats or if he stands his ground. He stands his ground. It's a bench between the two of us. So I had a little bit of protection there. And then I get close to him. I lower my voice. We're talking, and then I ask him, not do you use drugs, closed, but I say, hey, Keith, when you're using drugs, because I knew he was on drugs, but I'm like, hey, when you're using drugs, what do you use? And he's like, man, I like everything. I use everything. And I was like, oh, Keith, I love it, man. Thanks for the honesty. Then I reach out for a fist bump. Now he's holding a pen. Some cops are like, that's a blunt object. He could stab you in your jugular. I'm like, he sure could. And also, I just don't think that's happening right now. So I did a fist bump. Because human touch is powerful for oxytocin. And I just extend it. Cool. And then one of our sayings is the fastest way to gain compliance, which is the last part of this compliance, is exchange orders for invitations. Don't tell me what to do. Invite me in doing it with you. So I sat down first and I was like, hey, Keith, have a seat with me. I'm inviting him. He sits right down. We're still talking. We're talking. I'm reassuring his safety. I'm telling him what's going to happen. We're using something we call guided imagery. And then I'm like, all right, man, nobody's going to come do anything to you while we're with you. I assure you're safe. Here's what's going to happen next. We're going to walk outside, put you in the car. We're going to take you to get help. And I'm like, all right, Keith, let's go. I stand up. He stands up. He starts walking. He's got his pen still. I'm like, hey, Keith, we don't need the pen, buddy. Just leave it here. No problem. Drops the pen. Why? Because he trusts me. And now he walks himself out while he's paranoid, while he's psychotic, while he's on methamphetamine, no handcuffs, put him in a police car, take him to get help. And there's a lot of cops that are like, that is dangerous. I would never do that. I'm like, that's a choice, man. I can just tell you, I know you didn't see the full documentary yet, Les, but spoiler alert, when it ends, I didn't die one time. And a lot of people are like, look, man, I'm not trying to be reckless. I'm truly leveraging intellectual ability and using my own understanding of human behavior to get compliance. And that model is what we've used. It's what we teach. It's been a lifesaver, and I just wish everybody better understood it. And that's regardless. You don't have to be in public safety. That's if you're a teacher, if you're a parent, if you're anybody, which is what I love about this book is people think like, oh, it's for cops. It's not. It's for people. And if you deal with people, there's going to be value in that book for you, I assure you.
Yeah, I bet. It's also just like extending like dignity for the other person. It's a person,
yeah.
You know,
right.
Who's suffering. It's
Which to me, it's in the curiosity part, but that's where it's like, and when we're doing trainings, we touch on this a lot, but like introspection, self-awareness, empathy, like those are all superpowers. And the more genuine energy you have behind that, the easier your life is going to be. Like if you just show up like a dick and you're just barking orders, nobody's going to freaking want, I mean, they're going to do what you want them to do eventually because you have the power to make them. But they're not going to respect you. They're not going to want to do it. It's just going to make your life harder. And so like, why make it hard? like, just use your brain. And these are skills that you can learn and develop, because I'm proof of it. I didn't show up like that. I didn't just know all of this stuff. It's been a lot of due diligence, a lot of reading, studying neuroscience, listening to podcasts, listening to Andrew Huberman, listening to, you know, Joe Dispenza, really trying to understand the brain and then human behavior. And then also people like Brené Brown and Mel Robbins and like the empathy side of things, of like how to tap into the human spirit and like really connect with people. Simon Sinek on leadership stuff. It's all just taking an aggregate of all this information, and then how can I deploy this in real time when someone is at the worst moment of their life?
Well, sounds like you did a fantastic job compiling all that and having like a big toolkit. And then I guess you've just refined this skill of like grabbing the right tool at the right time for the task in front of you. So now you deploy this more of an educational thing. You have a company called Solution Point. Is that the idea? You're taking this model and essentially trying to scale it?
Yeah. So Solution Point Plus is the company that I'm the CEO of now. And we deploy these skills across multiple industries. So we're obviously in public safety. Our largest client is the Federal Bureau of Prisons. And so all federal prisons use our de-escalation protocols now. The public transit, we're up in Santa Clara County in California, teaching bus operators and light rail workers our techniques. We work with Indigenous police services up in Canada. We're in grocery stores. Like it really is just people that deal with people that tend to be in crisis. And we can give you the skills for that. So we've got multiple deliverables. We've got 1-day training, 2-day training, 3-day training, and a 5-day training based on what their needs are. We have basic de-escalation, intermediate de-escalation, advanced de-escalation.
Is that like you guys, logistically, is that you sending a rep or yourself to these, or is this video courses, or do they come to you?
All in person. Yeah, all in person. And I don't do as many anymore now that we're scaling and we've grown into a full-fledged business. I've got 10 facilitators that work for us that deploy around. I've got a team right now in California on a job. And so me as the CEO, I do a bunch of keynotes. So I travel around the country doing keynote speaking. That's like top of funnel. I speak at a bunch of conferences, and then I do the podcast, I do books, and that's just bringing awareness. Then if someone requests me or wants me to come do the training, I'll do the training. Usually there's an associated cost with that. But otherwise, all of our facilitators are trained under us, myself and Jesse, the co-founder. I met him in the Marine Corps. We've been friends 25 years now. He was on the police department with me as well. And so it's our techniques, our protocols that we teach our staff. We have videos to teach them, to onboard them. It's like a 3-month process. We make them regurgitate it. We make them teach it back to us. Then we bring them out to a training. We make them observe it and watch it. Then we do a warm handoff where we put our senior facilitator with one of our new facilitators to handhold. And then once we sign off on all of that process, now we say, okay, we're ready for you to deploy. But all of our trainings are 2 people, 2 facilitators. And so you're never out on your own doing it, unless it's me doing like a talk or a breakout session at a conference.
That sounds awesome. So are there openings for more facilitators if this really resonates with someone and they want to like be a part of that?
Yeah, I carefully tread here, because every training we do, 5% of every class immediately sends us resumes and wants to come work for us, which is great. So we've already got it is good. And we've got a pretty big hopper right now of people. Here's the problem. They're all subcontractors. So they're either, a lot of them are retired police officers or active police officers, but they have a lot of flexibility. We had social workers, but they left to take full-time jobs. We've got like the assistant attorney general of Iowa that works for us now as a facilitator. So it's diverse, which is great, but I don't want to have a massive bench if I can't feed them work. And so that's always the balance for me, is if there's not enough work to keep them busy, and we lost a pretty big contract for a short time. They're flirting with bringing it back online in the state of Iowa. I just met with them and they asked for a proposal, but we were cranking in Iowa. We were doing at least 2 in-person trainings a month in Iowa, and then bureaucracy, they redistrict, they did a whole thing. So all of that just stopped. And so I'm like, uh-oh. So now all my people, like I have a couple of facilitators that haven't had a job in 2 months. And so I'm careful about bringing people in, unless now if we hit a big contract and I've got like a 3-year runway on a contract and I know I need, that's when we'll tap into our hopper and see who we got on the bench and get them spun up as quick as possible. But Always yes. I mean, on the Solution Point Plus website, and it's just spelled out, solutionpointplus.com, there's a careers tab on there. You can just submit a cover letter and a resume, and we'll definitely add you to the list and reach out when the time is right. But some people show up like, save me. I want to quit my job and work full time for you. I'm like, hold on. We're not there.
Yeah. So. You got to grow. You got to be a good business model too. You got to stay
right.
Stay afloat. But I could see how it could be just such a rewarding field for many people out there that feel like they need a sense of purpose that makes them feel good about what they're doing and a sense of service.
Absolutely. Yep.
Well, Joe, what a freaking conversation. I had no idea what I was getting myself into today. It's fantastic, man. How do people learn more? They go to, I guess, solutionpointplus.com?
Yep.
And then how else do they find out more or reach out to you?
Yeah. So solutionpointplusallspelledout.com is the business website. And then I have a personal website, joesmorrow.com. There's no W on the end. I'm sure Les will put it in the notes, but yeah, just joesmarrow.com is my personal one. You can get the book there. Also, the book is on Amazon. You can just put in Joe Smorrow Unarmed. And then I do have another book coming out around Christmas time, called 12 Laws of Maximizing the Human Experience. And again, that'll be on the websites and stuff when we're ready to launch. And then social media. I mean, I'm on Instagram at Joe Smorrow, Facebook, LinkedIn, Joe Smorrow everywhere, and then the company Solution Point Plus everywhere. So I would love to connect with the audience. And I really appreciate you sharing your audience with me, Les. And kudos to you, man. Like, what you've built and what you're doing with the Mindful Movement is impressive as well.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, man, I'm honored to be a conduit for your message. It's a fucking beautiful message. I mean, I don't know. I can say it any more clear than that. I mean, I'm great. You've obviously gone through a tough road, and I'm grateful that you found the path from it. And it seems like you are right exactly where you need to be to make the world a better place. So, you know, I appreciate you, and I appreciate you taking the time to discuss this, and definitely appreciate the vulnerability that you offer up. I think that's an inspiring thing for people, especially men out there, to hear. And thank you. For the listeners, always grateful for your listening. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. And Joe, when the next book comes out, glad to have you back on and dive into whatever that's about, man.
Love it. Would love to. Yeah, it's been fun. You're a great host, and I appreciate you.
Thank you. Have a good day, everybody. Hope you enjoyed.